Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. And I hope, you know, this is a show that is not for entertainment. I'm not here. I mean, I may amuse people, and that would be great if you're amused, but the intent of the show is not to do that. And every once in a while, I'll say jokes that I think is funny, but, you know, just to try to keep it light. But as my wife says, most people don't think what I think is funny. It's funny. Anyway, all that being said, we give you content so that you can place context to what you need to do, which means that you can leverage the what you learn so that when you pray, it'll help in how you act. Learn, pray, act. So, on top of that, if you haven't garnered, everything is about constitutional compliance. Zero compromise. Full compliance. We cannot allow, if there's a problem, we want them to compromise because we want them to actually do something, then we amend the Constitution. We have a mechanism that can allow that. Even though I may think that them doing something would be good, the standard is it requires 3/4 of the states to agree. So it doesn't matter if you like it, the standards have been set. Therefore, we will comply to the Constitution, and before we even consider a compromise, there is no compromise. As a matter of fact, we don't even consider it because we can't. The Constitution doesn't allow considerations like that. Clearly, it is power granted, and only those powers granted. That's why that debt is fraud, folks. So, full compliance of the Constitution is the thing. This is why we have pledges for candidates to sign that they will fully comply to the Constitution. If they have doubts or questions, if they have any question of whether it's constitutional or not, they better ask. Because forgiving you for doing something, if you've actually violated the Constitution, you didn't ask. I mean, it's one thing to ask. And this was actually brought up, and I've said this before, and I say this to people, that if we have public servants that are in Congress today, we have public servants in your state legislature, and they are being asked, you know, they're being asked to vote on something, and they look at it and they go, is this constitutional? And if they go actually and ask, or they basically send an email off to a few of the journeymen that have been working in the legislature for a while and say, hey, I got some questions about this. I don't think it's constitutional. Are you sure this is constitutional? We should be doing this? And if they come back and they say, this is how it's always done, don't worry about that, or what have you, at least you asked. If you don't ask, you have no courtesies of saying, we can forgive you. If you just leap forward like Nancy Pelosi and create bad bills and say, you want to know what's in it, pass it first. If you do that kind of crap, we won't have any mercy. We shouldn't have any mercy because you didn't care. You callously moved forward in violating the Constitution. If you at least are looking to say, I want to comply to the Constitution, and I don't see how this works, and don't worry, you know, and however they explain it, it's better that you ask, because that way, at least for the first time, I want you to understand this, for the first time, when we finally get to full compliance, and then we look in your back history and we say, you know, these actions, this list of actions we have, that you voted for these things were unconstitutional, if you've asked each time, and, you know, are you sure this is constitutional? Yeah, we got to vote this way. And you just go along because you have no real knowledge, because nobody has the knowledge until they've actually read these documents. And so even though you should have been doing that, we will at least have a, you know, our bowels will give you a one-time, you know, pass. And what I mean by that is you will get a first and final. In other words, yeah, those are all unconstitutional. And now in the future, you better have explicit, this is why and how this is constitutional. You better have somebody be able to prove to you that it is constitutional. No more passes. If you violate your oath, you're gone after this. So in other words, we'll give people, you know, the benefit of saying at least you were asking, at least you were trying. But those folks who had no effort in challenging, they just, you know, oh, I want to be a good, I want to be somebody that is recognized as I'm willing to compromise, I'm willing to do what's necessary to get things moving. Those people are our enemy. They are in office to do those very specific things we've delegated to them. And right now they're all going in with this carte blanche, we're going to do all these things. And I will tell you that it is so bad today that I'm going to have a hard time. You know, if you're in your first year and you still are going along with the flow, you better be the guy that's voting against everything. And actually, you need to be coming back to your constituents and saying, I don't see how any of this is constitutional. And then going back to your constituents and saying, explain to me how this is constitutional. Explain to me the fact that we are regulating education, the environment, labor, all of these things. Explain to me how this is constitutional. Because then your I'll just call them your constituents, the voters in your district, you know, their burden is now you push back to them. And at least you're getting them engaged to say, you know, you're right. Now that you've brought that up, you're right. And we're so thankful that you're there. I think that that's how some people have been able to deviate, but bottom line, Rand Paul falls short. Tom Macy falls short. I mean, Tom Macy's probably one of the best as far as pushing back, but there's some things that he still allows. And I can't say that profoundly that I know. I'd have to actually look at everything, but you either are known for voting against everything, which is what you should be doing, because I don't think that there's anything that they're voting on that's constitutional, even if it's defense. I mean, it's one thing if you're declaring war. I mean, you have that authority and responsibility. Those few things that actually fall into that. But the majority of anything that has to do with money, spending, a bill like that, appropriations, taxing, those things are, you know, almost 100% bad, wrong, unconstitutional. So anyway, folks, this is why this is so important. Constitutional compliance. This is the game changer. There's no money in it for you. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, when they come in and they go, oh, you know, this isn't going to pay me. I can't make a lot of money doing this. No, the guys that ignore the problem, like Hannity, Levin, Beck, all of these conservative entertainers, they don't tell you what you need to be doing. And they're not going out of the way to show you exactly how these things are unconstitutional. They're not teaching you what the framers actually said. This is the only show that does that, folks. This is the only medium in the world that is giving you the truth. So I hope you appreciate it. And eventually, when people start recognizing that I'm having a huge impact, I will probably go away in the Italian sense. And so if you find my body, if you find my body cut up in the freezer, don't believe the suicide note, okay?
Right.
So there you go.
We know you're not suicidal.
That's right. But I mean, you know, the whole how did I kill myself and cut myself up and then put myself in the freezer?
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyhow.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Are you familiar with the education savings account bill that got passed in Wyoming?
So, repeat that. Am I familiar with
what?
I'm
just curious have you heard about the education savings account that got passed in Wyoming?
Okay. So,
it's where families can apply up to $7,000 per child per year to go towards their school of choice, whether it be homeschool, private school.
Okay, so are the parents are putting up $7,000, or the state is putting on the table out of the taxpayers' cost $7,000 per student.
Yeah, so it's a separate fund apart from the school fund where, yeah, the state is putting up the $7,000, up to $7,000 per child if you apply for it and don't want to go to public school.
Okay, so is that a power delegated to the state in the Constitution? Does the state...
I don't know. So it's been challenged.
Okay.
The constitutionality of it has been challenged, and it's been paused, so...
Okay. So it can go to the court, and the court will actually see a way to, you know, because the courts are so liberal, they will bend the interpretation of the Constitution to actually say, well, we see it there. It has to be clearly a delegated responsibility. It's one thing for the state to, you know, basically make a declaration that education will be free, you know, or, you know, and what does that mean? Academically free or cost free? Because it's far more important that education be academically free than cost free. Because if it's not academically free, then you're being indoctrinated. And that means that, so that's a huge problem. So you have to kind of, I just stress that you need to look at the Constitution, the Wyoming Constitution, and look up the word education, school, anything that kind of is, you know, lends to that. And you have to find that the school has the responsibility of funding every child from kindergarten to high school graduation. If they have the financial responsibility in the Constitution, then you need to amend that. Because even though it is good to for promoting education, promoting institutional education is bad, because institutional education is corrupt. Institutional education is about creating a self-licking ice cream cone. If it is about helping develop the cheapest, best quality education in the world, then okay, you got my interest here. Because there's no reason why you have to go to an edifice of brick and mortar that everybody has to pay for, the facilities and everything else. Why don't you go to church? Why don't you, why don't the people go to church and get access over the internet so the kids can actually go and the parents can actually be involved? The community can help give the children access to quality education. You don't have to teach. As a matter of fact, I've proven to you, I think, that a person, we don't want teachers in the classroom. We want video content so that a child can sit there and be taught the very specifics of factoring in mathematics and then be given examples and then actually take worksheets to go prove that they understand what they're doing so that they've been taught factoring. That right there removes the ability of a personal teacher to be able to wander and segue between one topic and the next. Oh, we're going to do factoring, and then we're going to get into, you know, this, you know, hyperboles or whatever. I'm not even going to try to say quadratics or whatever.
Quadrilaterals.
Yes, yes, thank you so much. Hyperbole, I get that. Hyperboles. My point is that in between those segues and transitions, the teachers, you know, in the classroom can get away with personal crap and say, I can't believe what Trump's doing. I can't believe what the church is doing over here.
Yeah, or show them clips from CNN.
any type of non-content of, folks, I may give you my opinions and you come here for that. And you come here for the facts as well. But when you're paying for an education, be taught, I don't want to hear any trifling crap and drivel coming out of a teacher's mouth going into my children's ears. That's not why we hired you. And as a matter of fact, here's the real problem. The education system puts a teacher usually into a into a topic like American history, this. You teach a few topics, and that's what you do the rest of your life. Instead, if you go look at yaymath.org, this guy has created a fundamental curriculum from basic education to college level education so that you can get all of your math without the garbage in, you know, his videos, so that the kids are actually learning the content. That's the kind of education our education system should be doing. And instead of, you know, paying people to just sit there and babysit, you can, you know, have the community kind of let every, you know, because how much time does it take to go and learn? And the child that needs the extra, you know, lessons, you know, going through the different topics or what have you, or to hear them again, or to get a little tutoring, okay, that's a little different. But most kids, when they have a good quality teacher that makes it interesting so that they can get it and understand the principles, go, okay, then they're only in the classroom. They're only there for a short period of time, then they take their homework home. So how long do you really have to be running, you know, an institution? And I only say this, or, you know, being in a physical space, because I understand Wyoming. People live in areas where you don't have the internet. Now, you've actually heard me say,
yeah,
I believe that that's infrastructure. That's a level of infrastructure that the state should actually be paying for. And not allowing Time Warner, AT&T, and the rest of these big conglomerates to get rich off of the people. Because you only need the internet. If you want television, that's something else. And then once you have the internet, you can go to Paramount. As a matter of fact, how many people have Prime? And you get all the crap that Prime wants to give you. Go throw your money on those things. Why pay for ABC, NBC, or CBS? You know, those guys used to be free, and they would you know, clutter their content with commercials. That's how they paid for it. And so right. I believe local news is necessary. So if you're going to have a local news, local interest, and personal things like that, then that's fine. And I believe the people should actually, you know, enjoy the commercials or skip over them. But the commercial, because I don't know if you knew this, but DVRs and technology's finally gotten to a point where they can actually cut out the commercials. They can, it'll sense the content going from one to the commercial, and then when it comes back. And so the DVRs could actually cut those things out. And the companies that are paying these broadcasting stations, you know, they don't want their content to go through those types of devices. They don't want you to have that device because they want to force you to listen to their stupid commercials. Look at what YouTube is doing. You actually have to pay YouTube so you don't get commercials. If you listen to satellite radio like XM or Sirius, then, you know, supposedly it's commercial free, but it's not. They're still telling you what they're doing on other channels. They tell you, oh, we're going to have these people. They're always talking about what they're doing, and they talk about things. You know, it's not like you're just getting music from Sirius and XM or the talk. And so one way or another, you know, they're imposing upon us, and they're trying to get us to either buy, listen to their crap, you know, buy into their pathetic causes or what have you. And I'm going, okay, well, that's fine. But if we want to develop technology to remove that, then we should have it. And I bet you everybody would do that. So it would force these people. Have you ever seen Minority Report?
Yes.
And we kind of see Minority Report in our lives today, because if you're using social media, if you're interfacing on a computer nowadays, with what they're doing in browsers, especially like Google, especially like Edge, Microsoft, the big tech companies, and I believe Apple is the same, you know, with their Safari or what have you, that the big tech companies are literally spying on you so that they can drive marketing towards you. And that's how they make money, by getting you to click on, you know, that advertisement, that, you know, that product. Oh, I'm looking for that. I'm looking for a crib. How do they know? Because there's been spying on you. So my point is that type of content, that type of stuff that they're doing, or I should say filtering through or peppering you in little advertisements and so forth, they're going to get to a point where you can't even avoid it. Because in Minority Report, as you walk along, the TV and the contents is constantly changing to the next user walking by, because you've got a phone, they're keeping track of you, and they know exactly what you're interested in. Hey, have you pulled the trigger on that new fridge you're looking at? I mean, that's how scary, you know, we're moving into this corporate world. And it's nice.
Tell my husband, tell your phone that you want to find a trip to Disney World for four people for under $2,000.
Yeah. So it's scary to think that we've actually gotten down this far down the path. So my point is,
it is scary.
But my point is that when we look at global corporations, these companies are not making just money for themselves. In other words, the money we're spending on buying, you know, this car manufacturer, you know, their product, we're actually spending money to basically pay off the investors, because they have to put so much profit and so much advertising. They spend a lot of money into you buying that product. Now, let me ask you this. If you really look at how much money they spend on marketing, and how much they've depended upon private, instead of actually making a great product, just making a great product and then putting it out there, how much more money do they spend on going to the public to basically invest in their next investment? In other words, these publicly traded companies, where their job has actually not been giving you the best product for the best price. Their job is to increase the value of their stock so more people buy their stock, and water down what you're really getting, right? I mean, if we actually had honest businesses, if we got rid of the market space, now, most people would say, oh, that's anti-capitalist. Actually not. Public trading is not capitalism. It's unfortunate. It is absolutely unfortunate that people are in that paradigm, because when we look at public trading, it is nothing but heavily regulated. Free market is no regulations. Free market is where you're paying for what you get. And outside of government controls and so forth. The reason why certain things cost the way they do is because government regulates it and says, well, you've got to put a label on there to tell people, you know, don't throw this dart up in the air, you know, so that if it lands on your kid, it'll kill them. You know, don't let your kids under a certain age, and at least make sure that they could get hurt. You know, if you, the lawn darts, right? I mean, that was a product that got wiped out because of, you know, this, I'll just say because the users were clueless, the stupid users, right? I mean, how many cars, you know, go out of business because, you know, a lot of people drive them fast, like sports cars. Why do they just stop making sports cars? Because people drive them to, you know, to excessive limits, fast, around corners, what have you, and they have accidents. Well, if that was the same premise, then those cars would go out of business. But no, they're not held to the same stupid liabilities and so forth. The fact is that there are consequences to your decisions. If you're going to buy kids dangerous toys and you're going to not guide them, not supervise them, and, you know, but the point is that we have to take on the consequences. You get to live with them. You live on the shoreline and you get wiped out from a tsunami. Well, whose consequence? Is that our fault that you decided to live on that beautiful parcel of land that once in every century, that land is overcome by a large wave that you're going to lose your household, or maybe once every 500 years. You just happen to be there in that one little cycle. We are not responsible. We shouldn't have to cover that. It's one thing for you to insure for yourself or what have you, but there are consequences to our decisions. We have to live with those. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so how did I get down this rat hole in the first place? Huh. Well, I don't know, but let's actually...
I'm not sure, but it was a good one.
Oh, okay, yeah. And a long one, because it took up a whole segment. So where we are is we're covering... Let me get this straight now. This is on the 19th, and this is Mr. Henry. We just covered, I believe, Mr. Henry talking about common law. And then Mr. Henry went forward a little more and spoke again. I mean, he went down a different topic, and we're going to give you another highlight that he shares in his oration regarding common law for the time. So let's go ahead and cover this. Again, folks, remember, he's an anti-federalist. So what he's saying is he's painting a picture to incorrectly cast light on the Constitution. Let's go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Henry then contended that there was real responsibility in the British government and sufficient security arising from the common law, Declaration of Rights, etc., whereas in this government there was no barrier to stop their mad career. He hoped to obtain the amendments which his honorable friend had proposed.
And so those amendments were the Bill of Rights. In other words, he keeps on saying that this is a very dangerous government because there's nothing that constrains them. Well, hold on here. They've consistently and over time throughout the debates every day have articulated one way or the other that the powers granted are the only things government can do. So how is it that they can do anything according to Mr. Henry? Well, it's easy. If they're going to do something they have no power to do, then they are violating the Constitution. So would a Bill of Rights actually protect us from usurping powers? Now, well, if you have a bill, so let's give you a good case in point. Because how long ago did the Department of Labor, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of the Interior, their ability to possess land, that... they usurped that power well before 1849 when they created the Department of Interior and actually started, you know, embracing these regulations of the land that they were going to usurp. Clearly, the Constitution enumerates what land and what purposes they can possess land for. Forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. If it is land for any other purpose than that, it is unconstitutional. So why did they create the Department of Interior? Because they were over their heads in land that they had no authority to have. They were already creating, this is why I've been covering, and Tammy, you've been missing this. I've been covering these different acts and the big land act of 1820, where they're basically imposing upon states to surrender 500,000 acres so that that's how they will sell that land and fund the development of railroads, waterways, highways, you know, infrastructure. And if you really look at infrastructure back in 1820, it's not like they were creating these huge engineered bridges that would last a century, right? I mean, it was just, you know, they're just clearing a road. I mean, the amount of money that it cost in doing that was really marginal. And so when you really look at the way the government, because it was exposed in these bills that the government was going to give the state 2% of the proceeds, they were going to pocket the rest of it, and in so doing, they would pay for the development of the road and the proceeds, like all of the extra money that the federal government was going to keep was going to go into building up the District of Columbia for education, for these other services that they wanted to create in preparing the District of Columbia to become a state. And we covered this when we covered the Organic Act, that when they crossed that line and started creating government, a separate body of government, to govern the District of Columbia, they violated the Constitution. Because only Congress has the power for exclusive legislation over U.S. property, not these governments they're creating. They had no authority to create a government to manage their properties. That's not in the Constitution. So anyway, let's dive down
to... So why did they let them do it?
Well, it's about ignorance. Right? So
I feel like back then they should have been less ignorant because it was more fresh.
Okay, so I say this a lot. Had the states done what they should have done when the Constitution was ratified, had Henry really cared about keeping government in check, Henry would have created a movement amongst all the states to say, give us and let's consolidate all of our ratification debates. And let's make sure that every state that joins the Union understands what this Constitution really means as it was laid out in the ratification debates, so that we can hold them to the delegated powers. He didn't care. The reason he didn't care was he was all in trying to undo the Constitution. And if the Constitution passed, then he was going to go down a different path of trying to kill it. And that path, as soon as the convention was over, or I should say the ratification debates were over, he started working with other states to call for a convention. And Virginia and New York were in cahoots. New York was the first to basically petition the federal government for a constitutional convention. Then a week later, Virginia walks in with some delegates and says, we want a convention. They were hoping that that would have brought other states to the table, and that was actually one of the deals that Madison kept on saying to Congress. I cover this with the Bill of Rights. Congress said, we owe these people a Bill of Rights. If not, then they're going to actually form a convention, and who knows what they'll end up doing, because they may actually completely delete this Constitution and go back to anarchy with the Articles of Confederation or something worse. So, this really exposes that these men, they may have had great points in time in history. Give me liberty or give me death, Henry. You know, he was a great guy. But all of a sudden, when these men in the Constitutional Convention were absolutely inspired by the divine hand of Providence to create a government so well designed, with checks and balances and empowering the people and giving political power closest to the people, where the counties were to possess the base of all government power. And yet we've got a completely different government. How'd that happen? It's because they have been trying to pervert this, and had Henry actually really cared about liberty, had he really cared about all these things he was saying, he would have created this repository and made sure that all legislatures were well indoctrinated in their job and duty to keep a jealous eye on the federal government and make sure that they're only exercising the powers granted. Right? We would never be in this mess. Mm-hmm. They would never have done all of the things like the Land Act, like, you know, establishing slavery in the Missouri Compromise. So many things started happening in the, you know, after Madison stepped down. After Madison left the presidency, things started going sideways exponentially. It was bad with Monroe. It was a little worse with Adams. It got really bad with Jackson and on. It just got worse and worse. They completely perverted the Electoral College by 1856. And yeah, folks, as I go through all these documents, we create this accurate picture of what and how all of these things were done. And I'm here to tell you that the corporations was just, you know, the next logical step of tyranny from what they had been doing from unconstitutionally establishing the bank with Hamilton in Washington's turn. And then the government kind of got bad, or even worse, with John Adams. And then Jefferson got the government back on track. And they actually let the bank expire. They didn't have a national bank. They got rid of it, or they let it expire. And then it was Madison who was forced to recreate it. But I'm telling you, I've never seen the paperwork of comparing the charters between the two. But I am convinced Madison did not create the grand charter that Hamilton did, where they were selling bonds and doing those types of crap, you know, creating actual bank products. This was strictly a bank for funding the war. And so when they funded the war, they were done. It was paying that debt off. And that's one of the reasons why, because Madison had an aggressive plan in paying it off. They paid it off early, and Andrew Jackson was the recipient of the credit for getting us out of debt, when actually it was Madison that was paying the debt. He was the one that created the plan to pay it off early so that we wouldn't pay as much in interest. But I'm telling you, Jackson had no compunction, had no moral, you know, I'll just say character, to actually be honest and say, you know, I'm the recipient of a great plan that was established by James Madison. No, this is an opportunity for him to get the credit. And that's exactly what they do. And that only proves the character of Jackson in contrast to Madison. What did Madison claim credit to do? Thank you very much. So, back to Henry. Go ahead and get into Pendleton, in response to Henry. Let's go ahead and get into what Pendleton says here. Go ahead.
Okay. The next clause settles the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, confining it to two cases, that of ambassadors, ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party. It excludes its original jurisdiction in all other cases, but it appears to me that it will not restrain Congress from regulating even these, so as to permit foreign ambassadors to sue in the inferior courts, or even to compel them to do so, where their causes may be trivial, or they have no reason to expect a partial trial. Notwithstanding this jurisdiction is given to the Supreme Court, yet Congress may go further by their laws so as to exclude its original jurisdiction by limiting the cases wherein it shall be exercised. They may require some satisfactory evidence that the party could not expect a fair trial in the inferior court. I am stuck with this view from considering that the legislature is not excluded by the general jurisdiction in the Constitution from regulating it to accommodate the convenience of the people. Yet the legislature cannot extend its original jurisdiction, which is limited to these cases only.
So the one thing he didn't bring up was that the hard jurisdiction period for the federal court was all things arising under the Constitution and its laws made in pursuance thereof and treaties made under their authority. So in other words, they had jurisdiction over the legitimate laws and over the legitimate treaties. What about, you know, a treaty like a treaty with the UN? That's not legitimate. If the state stood up and said, that's not legitimate, we're not following this. If the courts tried to actually step in with jurisdiction to claim, we're coming in here, the states only have to say, hold on here. How is that treaty within the enumerated powers granting the federal government the authority to adjoin the union and the federal government to basically be submitted to another governing body? Where did we delegate that in the Constitution? And the court would go, what? That's right. You only have jurisdiction over those things arising under the Constitution. This is a treaty that is illegitimate, that was not made under their authority. They assumed the authority, and now they've tried to impose it upon us. Therefore, you have no jurisdiction, court. Thank you very much. See my point? Mm-hmm. When the states actually start challenging, all of a sudden this revolving door in front of the federal courts will stop spinning. And the only thing that will be going in, and oh, by the way, let me point this out. He says the next clause settles the original jurisdiction, because this is original. This means that this is not an appeal, this is original. That the Supreme Court is confining into two cases, that of ambassadors, ministers, and consuls, and those, as well as treaties, as well as those in which a state shall be a party. Guess what? That last line doesn't apply anymore. Because when you look at the 11th Amendment, it basically, the states took back the federal court's ability to drag them in on original jurisdiction. Go look at the 11th Amendment. The states actually complained about that part right there, where a private person from another state or a foreigner would actually come in and say, hey, I'm suing you, state, and it would be pulled straight into the federal court. Because that's what Article 3, Section 2 did. It granted the federal court's original jurisdiction. Now, with the 11th Amendment, the 11th Amendment completely shut that argument down. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, actually, because it's always worth reading, right? So, Article 3, Section 2, this is what was changed. Because, actually, I'll just read the whole thing. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. Just adjusting here. Under this Constitution, the laws of the United States and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. So, in other words, they have original jurisdiction over all things constitutional. Laws that are constitutional, treaties that are constitutional. If they're exercising powers not delegated in creating the law or treaty, then they don't have original jurisdiction, and the states only have to stand up and say, hold on. You have no jurisdiction. That's not constitutional. You need to call it void and actually step in and do your job, court. Anyway, and then it says, to all cases affecting ambassadors or other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime. So those are cases that don't involve the states for the most part. And, you know, unless a state is exporting stuff over maritime law and so forth. But anyway, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, and that's where it ends, because the 11th Amendment basically changed everything else that follows. And between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands and or grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states and citizens or subjects. So in other words, when you read the 11th Amendment, it says you don't have jurisdiction over these things anymore because they were literally jumping into their knickers with original jurisdiction. This is all about original jurisdiction. And then the next part that comes in is, I believe, and when we look at Section 2, then the next part is basically in the appellate, right, in the appeals and those types of things. Because in cases mm-hmm. affecting ambassadors, public ministers, and those which states shall be a party to the Supreme Court have original jurisdiction in all of the cases before mentioned, and then it basically says, and the court shall have appellate jurisdiction both in law and fact with the exception and under regulations as Congress shall make. So Congress has the responsibility of keeping the court in check. And that's where the states should have actually been going into Congress, you know, getting into their grill and say, do we need to amend the Constitution? Or are you going to start regulating them so they stay out of our business? Stick to the Constitution. Don't worry what we're doing. If you want to worry about what we're doing, like commerce, that you're making these products and everybody's complaining about it. The Constitution only allows the federal government to regulate commerce among the states, not within the states. So if they're getting into their knickers about products they're making, things that they're doing. So anyway, let's keep going because I've sensed myself swimming a little bit too much here. So, okay, so the next point is common law that Mr. Pendleton addresses. So let's go into common law here and how he kind of refutes what Henry had been saying. Go ahead.
Okay. Let us consider the appellate jurisdiction if these words had been left out. The general jurisdiction must embrace decrees in chancery and in admiralty and judgments in courts of common law in the ordinary practice of this appellate jurisdiction. When there is an appeal from the inferior court to the court of chancery, the appellate jurisdiction goes to law and fact because the whole testimony appears in the record. The court proceeds to consider the circumstances of both law and fact blended together and then decrees according to equity. This must be unexceptionable to everybody. How is it in appeals from the admiralty? That court, except in some cases, proceeds as a court of chancery. In some cases, they have trials by jury, but in most cases, they proceed as in chancery. They consider all their circumstances and determine as well what the fact as what the law is. When this goes to the superior court, it is determined the same way. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Appeals from the common law courts involve the consideration of facts by the superior court when there is a special verdict. They consider the fact and law together and decide accordingly, but they cannot introduce new testimony. When a jury proceeds to try a cause in an inferior court, a question may arise on the competency of a witness or some other testimony. The inferior court decides that question. It either admits or rejects that evidence. The party intending to object states the matter in a bill of exceptions. The jury then proceeds to try the cause according to the judgment of the inferior court, and on appeal, the superior court determines upon the judgment of the inferior court. They do not touch the testimony. If they determine that the evidence was either improperly admitted or rejected, they set aside the judgment and send back the cause to be tried again by a jury in the same court. These are the only cases and appeals from inferior courts of common law where the superior court can even consider facts incidentally. I feel the danger, as much as any gentleman in this committee, of carrying a party to the federal court to have a trial there. But it appears to me that it will not be the case if that be the practice which I have now stated, and that it is the practice must be, and that it is the practice must be admitted. The appeals may be limited to a certain sum. I make no doubt it will be so. You cannot prevent appeals without great inconveniences, but Congress can prevent that dreadful oppression which would enable many men to have a trial in the federal court, which is ruinous. There is a power which may be considered as a great security, the power of making what regulations and exceptions and appeals they may think proper may be so contrived as to render appeals as to law and fact proper and perfectly inoffensive. How will this power be exercised? If I thought there was a possibility of danger, I should be alarmed.
So they mentioned common law here, but common law, again, has been conceded by the anti-federalists that the court and the federal government has not and is not operating within common law itself. In other words, they didn't declare common law to be the law of the land. What did that mean? That means that if they declared common law to be the law of the land, then a trial by jury is sacred. You can't step on that. That there are certain conditions that would absolutely require. But he points out here that in admiralty law and in maritime law and chancery and so forth, these types of things are not under common law. That's why they call it maritime law and chancery law, and or I should say maritime and admiralty. Chancery is literally something focused for the federal government because what is a chancery? It's an ambassador, right? And or this foreign relations and employment of the ambassadors at the federal government. So if there was a case that they needed to try and convict an ambassador, would that ambassador be afforded common law? No. The judge, or I should say the court, would basically have original jurisdiction, as well as they wouldn't necessarily have to afford a trial by jury because they didn't declare common law. So the whole point is that if you're going to work for the government, you're not covered under some of those protections in that particular employment. What ended up happening is they started creating common law precedent. So what is another part of common law? Common law is the application of case law and precedents based on rulings of similar cases, right? Case law and precedents.
Mm-hmm.
So common law allows the courts to kind of change the law. Had common law been embraced by the federal government, they would have been able to actually start changing, the courts would have been able to change the law. And by not having common law, the court's hands are now tied. They can't use case law and precedents, which is why they're forced to actually judge on every case based on law and fact, not case law and precedents. Does that make sense? This is something that they skimmed over. As far as I see throughout the states, they didn't realize what a godsend this was, this blanket of protection that we had from the federal government, that they couldn't actually introduce new law or twist the outcome of a case based on a previous case. Every case had to be heard on its entire merits, based on law and fact, based on evidence. Instead of being, well, this is a very similar case to this, and we're going to basically defer to the ruling in that and apply that here. That's how they sidestep the actual law and fact, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I know that more and more people that start learning about common law think that applying common law to the federal government would be great. No, we do not want that. We want them to basically be constrained to a very specific jurisdiction and not to develop jurisdictions with common law or even develop case law and precedents, because they've already done that. They have no authority to use case law and precedents. Show me in the Constitution where they have the ability to do that. It was very clear. They are to hear the cases based on law and fact. No case law, no precedents. So how did they do it? They started, with Marshall, they started getting out of the bounds. Marshall started creating opinions, and the federal government started realizing, hey, this court might be a way of us being able to assume more power. They worked together in breaking through the Constitution, from Congress assuming power and the courts assuming power. We're basically out of time. Thank you so much for your contributions today, Tammy. And maybe next time, you can keep me out of the rat hole a little better. Because it's hard to stop me. I get that, folks. I apologize. Anyway, we'll have Tammy back tomorrow, and we'll dive into more of the Virginia ratification debates. I promise, as we go through these things, you're going to hear what the truth really is. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.